KBOO.FM, and in that manner to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the WorldBeat PDX monthly series featuring Wamba on Tuesday, June 16th at the Analog Cafe in Portland. Wamba plays percussive jazz and funk with a strong WorldBeat influence and will be playing two sets that evening. Again, that's Wamba on Tuesday, June 16th at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang, and the show is Fight the Empire. And a lot of things to talk about. It's kind of a combo plate special. Got a lot of different items to talk about. And let's start out with the mass killing in Orlando. There's been a lot of discussion in the media, you know, about why did this man kill 49 innocent people? You could classify it as a hate crime, as terrorism, an act of insanity. Well, maybe all three. Some of the focus has been on whether he was he apparently pledged some kind of allegiance to ISIS. And so there's been discussion among these counterterrorism experts as to, was he part of a chain of command? Was he kind of instigated to do this? Was he aided to do what? What is going on here? Was he acting on orders? Sort of overlooked in all this, there was one survivor. I believe she was crammed into a bathroom with a bunch of other people, and Omar Lateen was there, and with his automatic rifle, and he was phoned somebody. That's where he declared his allegiance to ISIS. And he also told these people huddled in the bathroom that he was doing this in revenge for U.S. bombing of his country, which may refer to Afghanistan, since that's where his parents came from, although he was born in New York in the United States. So there is this connection, possibly, that this is a, you know, another blowback of U.S. bombing and drone bombing, but it was ignored, pretty much. Although Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton both came out with calls for bombing of ISIS, which is very interesting. That is what Russia is doing right now, bombing ISIS, and the U.S. didn't like it at first. The U.S. is kind of saying it's okay to bomb ISIS, but don't bomb the so-called moderate rebels in Syria. And some of these moderate rebels, they fight along with al-Qaeda. Well, of course, al-Qaeda was responsible for the, or they've been fingered as being behind the World Trade Center destruction. So what is going on here? Does the fact that ISIS is on the scene, does that somehow make al-Qaeda a little bit less bad? Well, apparently General David Petraeus thinks so. He was calling for possibly arming al-Qaeda in Syria They fight there under the name al-Nusra. And he was calling for arming them to beat ISIS. Well, this is really getting very conflicted here. All I can say is I can go to, I read a very interesting, funny little thing on the internet. This is back in 2014. And it was on a, one person named Leo G commented on a discussion. Are you confused by what is going on in the Middle East? Let me explain. We support the Iraqi government in the fight against ISIS. We don't like ISIS, but ISIS is supported by Saudi Arabia, who we do like. We don't like Assad in Syria. We support the fight against him, but ISIS is also fighting against him. We don't like Iran, but Iran supports the Iraqi government in its fight against ISIS. So some of our friends support our enemies, some enemies are now our friends, and some of our enemies are fighting against our other enemies who we want to lose, but we don't want our enemies who are fighting our enemies to win. If the people we want to defeat are defeated, they could be replaced by people we like even less. And all this is started by the U.S. invading a country to drive out terrorists who are not actually there until we went in to drive them out. It's quite simple if you understand it. So that was one that sort of explains, I think, a very good summation of our policy regarding so-called terrorists. And I just read very recently, this is a commentary by Stephen Cohen, who's been a guest on this show a few times. He is an expert on this, on Russia and the Soviet Union. And he has a weekly, conversation with John Batchelor. And you can access that through The Nation magazine. And one of the things that he has been talking about is the U.S. refusal to cooperate with Russia against terrorism. Russia has made all sorts of requests, you know, for U.S. help in combating terrorism. But according to Cohen, the U.S. has not been doing that. Well, the thing that's overlooked in a lot of this talk about Omar Lateen and the massacre in Orlando is that he claimed that he was getting revenge, his blowback for the bombing of his country or perhaps Syria. And this is one of the features of drone warfare that apparently our Washington warriors like, is that it's sort of pretty risk-free. You know, it's not like going overseas and invading a country and suffering casualties. We can do that bombing from here in relative safety. And, people who get bombed, you know, they may be furious, but there's nothing they can do about it. Well, apparently that drone impunity is going away. It is vanishing. And who knows that eventually drone warfare may become very, very risky to people here in the United States. The U.S. is not prepared for this. We've had a long history of being safe behind our oceans, and you know we can inflict damage on other countries in the world, but they really can't get back at us until now. So who knows? Who knows where this will lead? I'd like to talk a little bit about the economy. Of course, everybody here in Portland knows what's going on with gentrification, and there are lots of ways of dealing with this that have been put forth, and very much related to homelessness, because rents and the price of housing keeps going up, and this forces a lot of people out of their homes, and if they have some kind of income, they sort of forced into cheaper parts of town, or if they don't have enough income, they're forced onto the streets. And so there's different things. We try tent cities, we try dignity villages, we try putting them in empty buildings, all sorts of things. But the real cause of all this is basically a skewed incomes. You have a few very, very rich people and a lot of very, very poor people. And when people have the money, they can buy anything they want. They can buy neighborhoods. They can buy clean air. They can buy clean water. They can buy all sorts of stuff. And if you don't have the money to pay for that, you are kind of out of luck. So maybe while we're thinking of ways of dealing with homelessness and gentrification, we might think of the larger economy. Maybe we need there's been some talk of having a minimum income guaranteed to everybody. Maybe we should have a top income. Say if the top income is $2 million a year. That means that a person who of kind of psychopathic mentality cannot hope to gain more than that by pulling off all sorts of scams and criminal dealings. In other words, if you have this upper limit, it kind of limits in a way what nasty stuff people can do to get rich. If you can only get rich up to, say, $2 million a year, maybe that'll keep the damage down. The economy is really kind of in a mess right now, worse than other parts of the world. And there is talk of, this is kind of hard to believe, there is talk of a negative interest. Right now, I think the Fed just met, and they've Janet Yellen has said that, well, they're not going to raise the interest rates this time, but she does, I believe, say that sometime twice in the rest of the year, interest rates will go up. And there are actually some banks in Europe, I think Germany just joined them, where you actually have to pay a little money to put your money in the bank. Now imagine that. You go to the bank, you deposit $100 in the bank, and that money keeps shrinking. And say maybe a year from now you take it out and you only have $98. You've kept your money in the bank for all this time and you're losing money. Well, this is apparently this is what they're hoping, that this will encourage people to spend their money rather than stuff it away in the bank. Of course, the idea is that if you spend money, this will boost the economy and get things going again. Well, what's happening is that people are not spending their money. They're kind of hoarding it away. They're putting it away in the closet or under the mattress or wherever. And so now there is talk of, to combat that, there is talk of maybe doing away with cash altogether. And apparently this has been happening a little bit in countries like Sweden, where more and more transactions are done over the internet, with smartphones and whatever. And so some people are thinking or saying out loud that, well, cash is really obsolete. We don't need it. We can do everything we want with our iPhones. Well, that sure makes it easier for the government or any or big business to monitor where you spend your money. And it also makes it possible for somebody to, suppose everybody's money is tied up in some kind of an internet account. And so whoever controls that internet account can just, say, shave a couple percent off your balance whenever they feel like it. So this seems like a horrible idea, but people are talking about it. One of the things it also does, it pushes money into riskier investments in the stock market. And it leads to the question of if interest rates are so low, how do people save for their retirement? We keep hearing that, you need to, when you first enter the labor force, you should start socking away money for your old age. Well, if you don't get any interest for saving your money, how do you do that? It doesn't work. It's like we are urged to spend money and we are urged to save money at the same time. This is kind of one of the schizophrenic features of capitalism. Well, you have all this debt going on. is a wonderful interview. A person to really keep up with is an economist named Michael Hudson. And he, he's written a book that just came out. It's called, it's called Killing the Host. And that's just, this refers to parasites that kind of glom onto some living creature, and they feed off that living creature. But if they feed off that creature too much, the creature dies, the host creature dies, and so the parasite dies right along. And so according to Michael Hudson, we have an economy where, what he calls it, a rentier economy. In other words, that the debt has created a whole class of people who make huge incomes, not by producing anything. They sort of collect a little fee or rent or tax or whatever you want to call it on everything that happens in the economy. And so what they're doing is he calls them financial parasites, and they extract income from the real economy. And what this leads to is basically a future of what he calls debt deflation, kind of like a slow crash of the economy. One of the reasons for the negative interest is supposed to fight that. It's supposed, the people who run the economy want to have, they're hoping that we will have sort of like a constant inflation of like 2% a year, and that this will somehow keep the economy moving. Well, according to Michael Hudson, these economies can only pay debts by creating a financial bubble. And he writes about, he gave a very interesting interview. You can find it in there is a website called Naked Capitalism. And look it up, Naked Capitalism, and there's an interview with Michael Hudson all about this. And let's see, I just read a little bit from what he said. The financial sector today is decoupled from industrialization. Its main interface with industry is to provide credit to corporate raiders. Their objective is asset stripping. They use earnings to repay financial bankers, usually junk bondholders, not to increase production. The effect is to suck income from the company and from the economy to pay financial elites. These elites play the role today that landlords played under feudalism. They levy interest and financial fees that are like a tax to support what the classical economists called unproductive activity. That is what I mean by parasitic. So if you have a chance, read this interview with Michael Hudson and in Naked Capitalism. One effect of this debt is that the debt holders are able to repossess debtor countries. Greece is a particularly horrible example right now. And apparently one thing is happening is that because Greece owes so much to the bankers of the world, they are under a lot of pressure to, if you remember, the Syriza party ran under platform of getting rid of austerity that was imposed on the Greek people. Well, as soon as they were elected, Alexander Tsipras caved right in, and he's still caving in. Now, apparently, Greece is going along the U.S. and Europe. They want a gas pipeline to supply Europe with gas that does not include Russia. And they want the gas to come from Azerbaijan, which is kind of questionable anyway, and that it would go through countries that are not part of Russia. And so Tsipras, Greece, was been forced to support one of these gas pipeline schemes because he is vulnerable to his economies is dependent upon handouts, bailouts from the banks. So this is, you can see what is happening. Something similar is going on in Puerto Rico. Something very much like that happened in Flint, Michigan, where the city went bankrupt. And so the state of Michigan imposed this kind of a not an elected official, a sort of an overseer, a financial czar, to basically decide what Flint could spend its money on. And one of the things he did not want them to spend money on was at a water system that he wanted them to go for a cheaper water system, which resulted in the lead poisoning in Flint, Michigan. You have something very similar in Michigan at Benton Harbor, which is under this kind of financial overlordship because of their financial debt. One thing I'd like to turn to, a very interesting thing happening in Ukraine. There's a woman named Nadia Savchenko, who is a Ukrainian woman pilot. And she was captured. You know, Ukraine is at sort of in a civil war with its eastern regions, which are mainly Russian-speaking, Russia-supporting. And Savchenko was captured by the Russians and put on trial for involvement in the killing of two Russian journalists. And the according to the trial, Savchenko kind of fingered some sort of drone strike on these two journalists. And so she was put on trial and sentenced to 23 years in prison. And during the trial, she was kept in this sort of kind of like a cage in the courtroom, and she sort of acted up there, you know, giving the judge the finger and just kind of carrying on. She regards herself as a Ukrainian patriot. Well, the thing is that she was convicted, but then very recently Vladimir Putin made a prisoner swap with Ukraine. He sent Nadia Savchenko back to Ukraine, and in return for two Russians who are imprisoned in Ukraine. And now, apparently, people are wondering, what is Nadia Savchenko up to? She is sort of a hero in this country, Ukraine, and she's kind of stirring things up. One very surprising thing, she is calling for some kind of negotiations with the rebels in eastern Ukraine, the very ones that she had been fighting with before. And so people are wondering, did Putin kind of pull a kind of one-upmanship on Ukraine by letting this woman free and sending her back to Ukraine where she can stir up trouble for the Ukrainian government? People are wondering. Also, Russia, there's talk that Russia plans to, apparently Russia has hacked or they have gained access to Hillary Clinton's emails. And there is talk that they may release all these emails, however embarrassing they may or may not be. I don't think it's happened yet, but it could. And it makes me wonder, you know, of course, the U.S. is very upset about this. But at the same time, if you remember, a few weeks ago, we were talking with Pepe Escobar about the sort of this legal coup in Brazil. And according to Escobar, the U.S. Kind of set this thing going by the NSA was eavesdropping on Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. And they provided what little evidence these Brazilian coup makers have regarding Dilma's activities. So the U.S. does this kind of thing too, and well, we will see. Will Russia release Hillary Clinton's emails? We will find out. Finally, I'd like to say something about, Venezuela. Their economy is kind of in free fall. Terrible things are happening. People are not able to, you know, they can't buy food, toilet paper, all sorts of things, necessities of life. And a lot of this has to do, the U.S. has been after Venezuela now for a number of years, but certainly the U.S. is making it worse as they can, but you can't blame it all on the U.S. I think you have to, it seems getting very clear that that the Venezuelan government is partly responsible for the mess the country is in. I hate to say it, but I think it's true that the Venezuela got used to living on expensive oil. They had all this money flowing in. President Hugo Chavez was able to give deals, help out other countries, poor countries in the world, with Venezuela's oil riches, which is a very good thing to do. But apparently what he did not do was to install a plan B for what happens if the price of oil goes down, which it did. The price of oil now has gone way down. It's going back up again. But the economy of Venezuela has really suffered. And it's not just Venezuela. Other countries, other oil countries are in trouble too, like Nigeria, Brazil, even Saudi Arabia. And so the Venezuelan government has talked about economic diversification, but they haven't done a whole lot about it. And so there's a really good article. It's in, I believe it's in the Counterpunch by Lisa Sullivan, who's been living in Venezuela now for a number of years. And it's the title of it is The Venezuelan Crisis, The Real Culprit is Oil. I really recommend it. It's a good article. One thing she points out is that, people are in this country saying, well, look at Venezuela, that 19% of the children in Venezuela go hungry. Well, Lisa Sullivan looked up some figures and found out that in the United States, 20% of the children go hungry. So it's it's not just Venezuela, but that country did make some serious mistakes. They they depended on this sort of cash flow from oil to fund easy imports. Venezuela imports 70% of its food, which is kind of amazing when you think about it, because Venezuela, I've been there, it's a very fertile, lush country. It should not be importing 70% of its food. But apparently, with all the oil money coming in, it was cheaper to import than it was to produce. Well, now you see what the results of that are. And so this is, the oil boom. Eventually, oil was going to go away. It's either going to be too damaging to the environment, or it's going to become unavailable for the drillers. For one reason or another, we're going to have to learn to get along without oil, and we will be spending a lot more of our effort growing, just doing simple things like growing our own food. And so Venezuela, we can... people in this country may think of it as, well, this is a horrible example of socialism, ha-ha. But it's not just that. It's an example of what happens when you depend on a finite quantity of expensive oil to run your economy. You have to make plans for the future, and the U.S. has not done that. Finally, on a little bit of good news, in neighboring Colombia, apparently the government there has reached an agreement. They had reached an agreement with the revolutionary movement, FARC. They've also reached an agreement with a campesino organization regarding land reform. And this is a very hopeful sign. Also, if you're looking up stuff on the internet, look up Gaviotas. That is a town in eastern Colombia, not too far from Venezuela, as a matter of fact. Gaviotas has been around for about 30 years or more, and it's a town that is self-sustaining. It's sort of a model for what a future a future town should be. Gaviotas, G-A-V-I-O-T-A-S. Look it up. It's a kind of a very inspiring story. So this has been Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fogring. Stay tuned for KBOO, your radio station.
That's right, KBOO Portland is your community radio station. A couple minutes in front of 10 o'clock on this Thursday morning. We are getting set to kick off Flashpoints as Air Cascadia is off today. And then at 11 this morning, join us for Between the Covers. Today, host David Naiman speaks with Rob Spillman about his memoir, All Tomorrow's Parties. And then we'll wrap up the morning with a small piece from the series, Artipus. It's a weekly radio journey through the world of contemporary art. So that's coming up at about 11:45. Up next, it is Flashpoints, today featuring interviews about a Guantanamo prisoner who was finally given a limited chance to plead his case, and teachers in Chiapas, Mexico, who are on strike, plus the weekly election fraud bulletin with Greg Palast. That is all coming up this morning here on KBOO. Stick around.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Rogue Farm Corp's Happy Hour Open House Friday, June 17th at 6 p.m. at Hatch Innovations in Portland. Rogue Farms Corps exists to train the next generations of farmers and ranchers through hands-on educational programs. The open house will provide information about farmer training programs, have food, drink, and DJs Tobias and Dez. Again, that's the Rogue Farm Corp's Happy Hour Open House Friday, June 17th at 6 p.m. at Hatch Innovations, 2420 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Flashpoints. After 9 years, a little-known Guantanamo